Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 7 of the Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in East Nashville, Tennessee. I'm so glad you've chosen to join me once again as we take some deep dives with a cast of wonderful musicians, producers, and engineers that I've managed to track down and speak to about making music, records, and just doing what they do in their lives in music. Don't forget, there's a link to a playlist on Spotify and Apple Music with links to many of the songs we discuss on today's episode. You'll find links to those playlists in the show notes below or at our website. Meanwhile, the show continues to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription, which is a monthly payment of your choice. And when you sign up for Patreon, you get an ad-free version of the show to listen to, as well as getting entered to win a cunning prize pack from our sponsors at the end of the season. Or if you're tight for dough and you still want to help out, you can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just by spreading the word, sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, a huge thanks to the sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know I sent you. They are Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra 1964, The Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resophonic Guitars, and The Hen House Hang. All right, thanks so much to you for tuning in, and let's get down to it. Howdy, music nerds, and welcome back to the show. This is episode number 147, and my guest today is a masterful songwriter and singer from the Winnipeg area now, Mr. William Prince. Thanks for tuning in. I really do appreciate it. So I'm catching up here with two weekly back-to-back episodes due to missing one a couple weeks back when I was out of town and too busy to be able to get one out. So now we're back on schedule. It's back to first and third Wednesdays of every month. There's a new episode coming at your ears for the rest of the season. Okay. So meanwhile, I've had a great and crazy busy week, I guess, here at the studio working with an artist from Regina. Yes, Regina in Canada, but we worked here. His name was Jeff Straker, and he came down here to the Hen House, and we recorded the bulk of a really cool record here over those days. Brought in some great friends and great players, and we let her rip. I gotta say, you know, making music this way with a bunch of people playing music together, every project kind of takes on a life of its own, and there's like memories and feelings that go along with each project that I know would not happen if we weren't working in a room together. So I'm very thankful to be back with humans making music. Oh yeah. Anyway, now I'm gearing up to launch into another project with an incredible singer named Ndidi Anokulu, and I've worked with her before and looking forward to doing that again. That kicks off here in a couple days, so I'm pretty excited for all that stuff. I hope everyone out there is having a great summer. I've definitely been in the studio a lot here, but haven't been playing live as much as I'd like, I guess, but hopefully that'll balance itself out a bit. Who knows? These days, I dive in and work wherever the work is needed. Okay, I should mention that the giveaway we're going to be doing, which I've talked about before on the show, I'm going to be releasing some info on what's included in that soon, but rest assured, it'll be a killer prize pack, which will include at least a groovy guitar pedal from Union Tube and Transistor and a bunch of other cool swag from our other sponsors. So as a reminder for that prize pack, anyone that's a Patreon member, a supporter of the show, will be automatically entered, and the winner will be picked randomly from there. So you can sign up for that with a minimal monthly payment to support the show over at the website makersandshakerspodcast.com. So on the show this week is William Prince. He came by the Hen House here to talk with me on the eve of his grand old Opry debut, which is very exciting for him, and it was exciting for me to have him here. William hails from the Peguis First Nation in Manitoba, which is a couple hours outside of Winnipeg. I think it's north of Winnipeg. which Winnipeg, though, is where he now lives. And he's just released this killer record called Stand in the Joy. And it was great to get a chance to talk about that album, how he wrote the songs for it, how he recorded it, as well as his own personal music history and his upbringing around music. He's made a few records here now in Nashville and Savannah with Dave Cobb, and they really do sound amazing. Great playing, great vibe, and man, what a voice William has. I just saw him again a couple weeks ago when I backed him up for a couple of tunes at a workshop at the Vancouver Folk Fest, and man, that dude can sing. He's a Juno Award winner. He has a bunch of other accolades and awards for his various records. His last couple are really deep and amazing sounding, so check out Reliever from 2020, the new one, which I mentioned, Stand in the Joy. And also right after Reliever came out, he also put out a really traditional sounding gospel record, and that's cool too. And that's called Gospel First Nation. So William's going to be out working a ton this year and next year as well, I'm sure. So check out all of his dates at williamprincemusic.com. And when I was searching to verify that that was his website and searching William Prince, as you can imagine, mostly Prince William pages came up on the search engine. But William Prince Music is where you will find him. So let's get down to it. Thanks for listening. Please enjoy my conversation with William Prince. Yeah, I mean, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your relationship with Nashville a bit, because you've made a couple of records here now, It seems like you keep coming back. It comes up in a couple songs too.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of this place? Like, it must have affected the way you make records, but from your point of view, what draws you back to this town?
Well, it speaks for itself. This town, when you're a Canadian, when you're from a northern reserve, First Nation, Nashville is a thing of lore, really. It's the town. This is Music City. This is where all country music is born and dies, it feels like, when you're from there. Just say Nashville and it's synonymous with music where I come from, for sure. And we're really just a straight shot up from here to get to Winnipeg, and that's where I currently live. But Peg was First Nation about 2 hours north of Winnipeg.
Oh, that's where you grew up.
That's where I hail from originally. Okay. I've spent the latter half of my life in Winnipeg now, but that's where I started, for sure. And Nashville just means a lot because you almost feel like you can find an answer here, and you can feel it's going to do something to your music. I am very much a strong believer, and if you can't write a song in Winnipeg, you're not going to be able to write a song here in Nashville. So I do have that kind of mentality towards it. I think this place is just like you shoot hoops in the driveway and then you get to go do it like on a real court. It just kind of elevates who you are and your experiences.
Yeah.
All that stuff. So I love this town,
Have you spent a lot of time here over the, obviously you made records here, but have you also come down to do any writing or anything like that?
No writing. I'd love an invite, I'm ready. I've got coming up on a dozen visits, I'd say, somewhere in that neighborhood, different radio things and, over the years working with Dave and Dave Cobb and, I've made at least a piece of almost every record I've made has been made here in Nashville, and
including the first one. Like I couldn't find any credits on the first one, so
the first one I made and self-released, my debut of sorts, and then that was back in 2015. It would have been just the end of 2015. And then I got a deal, and then we re-released that record, new packaging, remastered. And
the
all
same
that.
Record.
Yeah, the Earthly Days record.
Yep.
That came out again in 2018, essentially. And what I had done was we took a song, Breathless, from that record.
Yep.
And under the motivation and advice of the label at the time, they said, who's your dream producer? Who would you love to work with? And I just, I thought of the person that makes all my favorite music, all these records that Dave Cobb has made over time. And the fact that, like, a friend of mine, Coulter Wall, made a record with him.
Sure.
And we're essentially provincial neighbors, he's Saskatchewan, I'm Manitoba, and just felt like, wow, like
could do it.
A Canadian can go down there and make a record. So that was a big big inspiration behind working with Dave. I love the sound of his records, and so it was really, that's my experience in Nashville is making records here. That's about the quintessential experience, I'd say.
It sure is. So starting from the second record, so you worked with Scott Nolan though, right?
Yeah, my good friend Scott from Winnipeg, and we made the first version of Earthly Days entirely in his studio, and went on to win a Juno from there, and that's what led to the signing and the remake, the remix, and our remaster, I should say. And but yeah, Scott's been a part of every record. He made half of Reliever as well. I made I made half of Reliever down here in Nashville, and then I put out an ode to the first learnings of gospel music that I've ever done. I made this record called Gospel First Nation.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that too.
So. But it was just the time, you know, after what we had just been through, the kind of the big pause, I felt like I was starting my journey up the American mountain all over again, you know? it's a big territory to conquer when you're from Canada, especially. You gotta, you're not just a transfer student to a new school, like you're a international student. And so I have all the respect for the American artists that you know, break through in some way and make some kind of headway up this this mountain we climb together, especially considering that Canadian artists a lot of times can be backed by government funding to go on tours to make records. So I'm fully aware of the grind it is down here, and so I'm just trying to make my way as organically as possible, you know. And starting over, I thought the best way. I can't really live down here right now. My son needs me, you know. I'll always be.
You got a young son.
I got
son,
a 6 year old
right?
son, and I'll always be in his hometown until, you know, he doesn't really need me. He can fly on his own to find me again someday. But maybe Nashville will be a spot one day, and until then, I'm happy to make the journey and and be here.
Yeah, it's not that hard to get here.
Yeah, we need a direct. Winnipeg needs a direct to Nashville. Yeah. I think
that Calgary one is totally unreliable.
Oh, geez.
There's that direct to Calgary, and it's cool when it happens, but it's like three times a week and seasonal.
Sure, yeah.
So it's not ideal. I'm from Vancouver. So.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I've spent my fair share of time in the Peg.
Yeah, my partner is born in Victoria, but she grew up south of Calgary, and so she lives in Winnipeg with me going on 4 years now.
I made a bunch of records for Big Dave McLean. You probably know that guy.
Oh, my goodness.
And Carrie Latimer, you probably know her.
Yeah.
Leaf Rapids, I mean,
of course. Love Carrie, love Dave.
I've done a bit of stuff with Scott, like at festivals and stuff like that. But
wow, so we're old pals by proxy.
Buddies.
This
yeah,
is
man.
Fun.
Yeah.
Jeez. Oh, well, let's hit record then.
Yeah, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your situation growing up on the reserve, like what it was like. So 2 hours north of Winnipeg, that's up there, man.
Yeah, you know what? It's not that remote. When you think of like really remote, that's when we're talking by plane. Like my mom was raised in Churchill, you know, way up north where you got to fly into it, take the train to it. And some of those places, when you reach the 7 hour mark north, that's when it starts to become northern, you know? So thankfully I was just 2 hours from Winnipeg. So we would make, or my family, you know, we do our monthly grocery shopping and put stuff in the freezer, and it was always a nice time. My dad only got paid once a month, so at the end of the month we would go and
you'd be flush,
you know, go and restock and pick up a CD or something, or a season of a show on DVD, and like get your fast food that you don't get when you're living in the country. So yeah, we were total city travelers and multiple trips a month kind of thing, so we had access. And thankfully, you know, Peguis is it's got a ways to go, but it is one of the more I guess advanced reserves, where in terms of like we have more adequate housing than a lot of reserves. We have more running water, you know, that's clean and drinkable, and the community itself is really vibrant in that sense. That's not to say it could use triple the opportunities and employment and resources for dealing with all sorts of things. But I was lucky that I grew up in Peguis, surrounded by a community that knew my family and my history with that place. You know,
you've got some pretty important history there, right? Like your great grandfather one of the
he's the founder of the reserve, Chief Peguis. So that's where my name comes from, you know, Chief Peguis, and decided after meeting Queen Victoria that he would name all his sons.
He met Queen Victoria.
Yeah, back in way back, the Treaty of 1871. And, you know, from that day forward, he was asking Queen Victoria, what are your sons called? And she said, well, all my sons are princes. And then when adopting an English name, William King, you know, right. Chief Peguis was dubbed King of the Indians. And so he became William King, and all his sons thereafter were princes. So I got grandfather's name, William Prince, Henry Prince, George Prince.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a pretty British sounding name.
Yeah, it's about the most British colonized name you could possibly have.
Yeah, colonized is a better word for it.
Indigenous singer, I know, I'm aware.
So was there music around there a lot? Like, I know that, you know, from some other people I know that have grown up on reserves, that there's a lot of, you know, some people grew up around a lot of blues and country music definitely is a thing there. What was it like on your reserve there?
Well, First Nations people, I'm not going to speak for all of us, but a vast majority have a really good ear for music. And, you know, I think of my dad's influence, country music, huge on reserves. Because you're living in the country. We're not that different. We're people from a small town. Like, we turn the reserves into small towns. There's small town drama, small town romance. There's
small town talk.
Pardon me. You know, there's driving in trucks down a gravel road and sitting with your baby on the tailgate stuff. There's baseball tournaments, there's hockey tournaments, and there's always something blaring on the stereo in the arena or out in the field, and it's usually along the lines of, you know, AC/DC and such. And then you think of the country, like, you know, Steve Earle and all the greats like Johnny Cash and Christopherson, Willie and Merle, and all the great, you know, the cloth of great country lives out there. And then all the Canadian favorites, of course, that we love, like the Tragically Hip.
And sure.
So it's a country rock nation for sure. So my exposure would have come from my dad's modest collection of music.
What were some of the things that stuck with you that he had around the house?
Well, I was lucky too, because my parents had a DJ business for some time. And you as a Canadian may know the concept of a social and like people getting married and having a wedding and stuff. It's a very Manitoba thing, but if you have this like gathering of people before you get married, it's like a big party to help you get married, essentially. Your friends will buy silent auction tickets and drink up the bar for you and basically help you pay for your wedding.
Yeah.
So my parents would often DJ these events. So they'd haul in the, you know, the cassette collection.
The cassette, and just the turn cassettes into were going strong back
CDs,
then.
CDs, you know, were really taking off. And he would DJ these dances. You know?
DJing with cassette. That's a talent.
Dual tape decks going, you know, and you got your Billy Idol at 1 a.m. kind of thing. Moni shutting it down.
Of course.
All that stuff. So that was always around. And I love the classics that he loved, all the big voices. He was a baritone singer. So he favorited all the great baritones.
So that runs in the family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Deeper voice than mine.
Really?
You know, I think of him and his love for Charlie Pride and Cash and all those kind of essential voices of that time. And then my mom's balance was the Beach Boys and Whitney Houston and Anne Murray, you know, and all these greats, Joni and Celine, you know. I just think of these great artists that come from Canada as well. But all of that found its way into my mind, into my being. Then I just loved the rhythm of music. I loved singing. I was not a good singer then. And, you know, always finding and learning my voice to this day.
Did you ever go through a period of learning a bunch of like country tunes or anything like that? Was that part of your background?
No, I've learned a couple hundred gospel tunes.
Okay.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
And that's the grape before the wine, you know?
Right.
Like that's the root of most stuff when I think of like old Hank Williams and like the framework for song that would have found its way into music, like John Prine and again, Cash and such. That stuff was very much in the periphery of my childhood all the time.
So somebody like Prine, that's a little more, I mean, it's not like he's obscure, but it's not mainstream country and really never was. Was that something that was also kicking around in your family's world? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When I think of the wide collection of things now, on top of these classics, I would also stumble upon things like Green Day, you know, and different pop records, Meatloaf's Battle.
How would you
hell.
Come across that stuff? Like radio?
It was in the CD collection.
Oh, okay.
So it was
they
in
had to play
my
it at
home,
the weddings.
You know, like they would play When I Come Around at the weddings and such. So I had access to a number. I would pull a CD, look at the cover, look at the band, the Gypsy Kings, you know, and just thinking of these wild records I would listen to and really take in music as a young person. So
was there any rebellion in it at all? Like, were you like, shit, that's my parents' music. I'm not really digging that. Or
you know,
were you always into it?
I was not rebellious. I was I was a safe kid. You know, I had my eye on a different prize. You know, when you do really well on the reserve, they will send you to university and help you with a small allowance to help with the cost of tuition and books and your monthly expenses and basically, you know, pay for your education so that you can go on and do something, contribute and, you know, make the reserve proud, be an ambassador of this place. I'm very much an ambassador of my home nation, you know, and I just got a call today about how proud they are about the Opry and such and just different things that are going on in my life right now. You know, and but yeah, I'm influenced by all music. I was lucky that I had some, and then you know we were lucky to have satellite, so I could watch the music video station once I was a teenager to start forming my own loves for music. And I really, they kind of go rock or rap, and I went the rock and roll route, you know, heavy bands, screamo, emo, pop, punk, all those things. They were all kind of tying in together, and I just loved consuming music. I was like they got the 96 CD book at school with me at all times kind of kid, you know, big can headphones, and in between classes, I was in a different world, dreaming of being there.
So did you start performing when you were a kid at all?
Yeah, I had a terrible cover tribute band in high school.
Sweet.
And, you know, I would always play Metallica songs and such. And
could you sing that stuff or were you just...
I tried, I'm not an alto singer.
I can't picture you doing it.
But it was definitely a voice that was put on, you know.
Yeah.
It had a rock cadence to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you imitate what you love at the beginning.
Totally.
And that's what I was doing. I was headfirst into the big Marshall Mesa Boogie stack amps and the effects pedals. And that's what I thought my musical life would be, you know.
You pictured yourself like in a rock band.
Yeah. You know, and then just...
Did you have any success with that? Like, did you do any stuff outside of
I made
of
a
your...
record when I was like 22 with
did
a
you?
Band, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's if you look hard enough, you can find it. It's not...
What was the band called?
Well, you can go find it.
No comment.
But that
where,
was just
where did
great...
you make? Where did it, like? Was that? Was there a studio up where you were, or did you go to Winnipeg? Or...
No, I would have been in university, so I was in Winnipeg already and established there for school and saved up some money with some friends, and we all, you know, I wrote all the songs, and they were all budding musicians who were, you know, really finding their own craft too, and so we collaborated.
Winnipeg's got a pretty sweet live music scene, always has, but like it's pretty noticeable now too that it's a strong supportive community. Is that something that you feel a part of, or do you feel like you are gone so much that it's not necessarily a huge part of your life anymore?
I like to think I'm a part of it. You know, we support each other to a degree. It could still be more. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of everybody's rooting for me when they see me. That's how it feels for sure. When I go to the Times Changed High and Lonesome Club, you know, I feel like it's like Cheers down there, you know, everybody knows your name kind of thing. So as far as belonging in the Winnipeg music scene, as long as I got a friendly greeting at Times Changed, I'm going to always feel
that's pretty
part
much
of
the,
it, you know?
The bar to set, right?
That's the one. So
do you ever play there?
I have, you know, in the past, I've featured on a performance of Scott's. I may have sang a one-off song. And then I had, in 2019, I had my own show there. I had to do a night at times, and they sold it out for me in a second. And
what's your usual haunt for Winnipeg? West End Cultural Center or something? Or where do you play?
For years it has been the West End Cultural Center. Jason Hooper and co. Mm-hmm. over there take such good care of me. And I just recently graduated to the Burton Cummings Theater.
Oh, nice.
So, we did 1,600 seats sold out for my last show there in the fall.
That must feel pretty amazing, eh?
Unreal feeling,
that's a great theater too. It's sort of like that old school Canadian kind of.
Oh, it's totally vaudeville and like meant for acoustic sound. So a quieter show thrives in that building, and that's where we're a quieter show. So
I played there with Matt Anderson last. I was in his band. We went through probably in 2019. We were not a quiet band, and it still sounded good.
Yeah, it's great. I opened for a number of people there too, like leading up to my own moment. That's the building I saw my first concert in for real. Like,
what was that?
I was 11. I saw Corey Hart there.
Nice.
I might be obscure. Everybody knows Sunglasses at Night. That's, so I saw Corey Hart there, and then I'd go on to later open for Dwight Yoakam in that building.
Wicked.
I opened for a band called The Watchmen, a great rock band from Canada. Yeah. And then I did one of two nights in Winnipeg opening for Neil Young in that building.
Shit. So
to go from that experience to my own,
people must freak out when Neil plays in Winnipeg, I bet, eh?
Well, it was really neat because he was on a solo tour where he's doing, the guitars in
the
a circle
and all that stuff.
All
yeah.
the five, four pianos on stage, mm-hmm. essentially. And so I did a few shows with him in the States, and then to do Winnipeg the night before and the night of my birthday.
Oh my God.
Is like a pinch me kind of moment,
Yeah.
And threw me a birthday party. Unbelievable, Like Neil and Daryl Hannah, his wife.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
His whole incredible crew just sang me happy birthday.
Amazing.
They always pour the love on me. I don't know what I did to align in the same cosmos as
did
Neil.
Did that come out of the blue? Like, had you met him before or anything? Or
I was singing a song at the songwriters Hall of Fame induction for both Bruce Cockburn, another beloved Canadian genius artist, mm-hmm. and Neil was like the secret inductee that night. So he happened to be in the building.
Okay.
And then I sang a song by Bruce, Stolen Land, with my friend Alyssa P. Isaac, and she and I sang that Bruce Cockburn song together. And I guess Neil, I had the pleasure of sitting and having dinner with Bob Young, Neil's brother.
Oh, yeah.
And he told me the whole story of how Neil was really moved by the performance. And
wow. Does Bob still live in Winnipeg?
No, Bob lives in Ontario.
Okay.
near where they grew up. So, but he travels with Neil once in a while. And he shared that wonderful story of Neil was moved by my performance and said, we got to have him along. So,
man,
incredible feeling.
Yeah.
And so I got to meet him that night in the stairwell. And he gave me a big hug.
Wow.
And, just felt so great. What a moment that is.
Was his music something that you'd grown up with as well? Like,
Neil's rock music was in my life.
More the
I didn't even know of Neil Young's true acoustic, catalog. Until you get a little older, and of course, Heart of Gold's on the radio, and Keep on Rocking in the Free World was basically the main Neil Young exposure I had.
When you were a kid, that was probably...
And you're a kid, you don't understand it, He makes fun of his own singing and stuff. It's not perfect pop production, you don't get it. It's like, Neil Young is like Seinfeld, You get older, and you really appreciate the genius of what it is, and so... Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I've been going through all his records. I subscribe to the archive,
Yeah, me too.
I keep up with all those things. I just ordered the 50th anniversary. I just got my 50th anniversary harvest in the mail for Christmas just in time. So, yeah, I'm so grateful to Neil, and I'm probably, getting to be one of his biggest fans.
Are there some shows with him in the future as well?
I don't know when he's coming back, He's got his own thing going on right now. He's got, he doesn't want to perform at venues that don't have locally sourced foods. He's very passionate about that. And his own carbon footprint is something he's always working on with his, the fuel in the bus and the going electric and things. And Also just, you know, just from what he's spoken on about like being safe with COVID and such. So I don't know. I'd love to be there if he makes his way.
Yeah, I heard him
when he makes his way back.
Rick Rubin's podcast recently, and he's kind of lukewarm about whether he's going to play ever again, kind of thing.
Yeah, so, you know, 75 now, but he's still spry. And
yeah,
I just saw him on Howard, you know, not long ago. Mm-hmm. I follow all the stuff, so anywhere he goes, I'm usually there.
Tell me about like what that period was like between when you're playing in rock bands and like doing that thing up until you release your first record, which I don't know that one as well, but I mean, at that point, it seems like you're kind of more or less fully formed as the artist that we know you as.
Sheesh, that's nice
today.
To say.
Well, I mean, you've found your voice, like literally your voice is like, you know, in good form at that point. You obviously know its capabilities and how to use it.
Truthfully, I'm testing it on that record.
Yeah.
You know, I finally just said, I've been trying to mimic and imitate.
That's what I'm wondering about. Like, so like how, what brought the individuality of your voice out, do you think?
It really came from a few years of hanging with Scott Nolan, not making music, and just getting to know one another. And, you know, he's the one that guided me very gently and lovingly towards like the power that's in my natural voice. Like basically it's just a slightly elevated version of my speaking voice, you know? And, I don't know, the things that used to make me the most insecure, the baritone voice and like my size and even being First Nations, you know, are the things that are most memorable about me now. Mm-hmm. And it was back then that I gave them a chance to shine, you know. I said I can't call it quits on my music career without having any music in the world. You know, I got to try. There's got to be a jumping off point that we can compare and contrast to later down the road. Now we're four records in and you can feel like the growth within them.
Totally.
And like, that's what I love is that it started everything. It got the wheels in motion. And I was so fortunate to have any attention on that first record is something you hope for. And people made a space for me. So
at this point in the show, I'd like to thank our amazing sponsors for the season. We couldn't do it without their support, and this year they are Mule Resophonics. Swing wider for inspiration with Mule Resophonic guitars. These are Resophonic guitars built for acoustic guitar players. Not just blues guitars, not just slide guitars. You don't need to play them in open tunings. They're set up with normal acoustic guitar action, and they have some of the best feeling necks in the game. Trust me, they're wicked. These musical tools wake up your ear and influence your playing towards uncharted musical realms. Check out the current lineup of guitars at the Mule Store at muleresophonic.com. Thanks to Spectra 1964. For over 50 years, Spectra 1964 has established a reputation of creating some of the most innovative recording equipment on the market today. Their consoles and preamps were behind the sound of so many great American studios of the 1960s through to today. Spectra 1964 continues the legacy of providing incredible recording products for the home or professional studio. Check them out at spectra1964.com. Union Tube and Transistor. Union is known for guitar effects pedals with a focus on quality and simplicity. They build durable, repairable products that sound amazing both on stage and in the studio. Their fuzz effects and compression pedals are insanely cool. I use the Sonebender Fuzz, the Moor pedal, the Lab, and the Swindle Overdrive all the time in sessions and live on stage. You can find out more about them at uniontone.com. And finally, the Henhouse Hang is a 3-day immersive recording experience at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville with me, Steve Dawson. It'll be in September 2023 and then upcoming again in September of 2024. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll show you the ropes of recording roots in Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Henhouse Hang. All right then, let's get back to the show. Like, how did the writing process start for you? Because had you been, there's sort of a period where, like, you weren't a kid when you put your first record out.
No, I was 29.
Man, that's pretty, yeah.
Yeah.
It's old, man.
Yeah.
So, like, what was going on musically in your life up until that point?
I was trying, you know.
You were?
I was, it was a matter of money. I had a lot of hard years where, when I left university and, you know, had personal struggle that eventually took me to China, you know, to live with a friend for a while. And then
really,
yeah, I stayed there with one of my best friend, and a hard relationship that took a lot from me and kind of left me spinning and reeling. And I went and got back on my feet living in China for few months and wrote a bunch of songs there.
Did you?
And then it would have been 2014 that I came home from China, and I'm sitting back in the same apartment, no further ahead, you know, really, other than the experience. Like, I was thinking, I spend my whole time there playing music every night. I lucked out, and I was supposed to just have a weekend.
In China.
Yeah. So I was supposed to have a weekend gig.
Yeah.
And the bar managers heard me and connected me with all the other bars that the expats would go to. So all the Western kind
of
themed bars.
What part
of
China was this?
Guangzhou.
How did you end up there?
Well, my best friend was a teacher there.
Oh, okay.
And it was the Manitoba curriculum that they were teaching at the private school.
Whoa.
And they always needed subs. So he paid to have me over there. He's like, hey, man, you're not yourself. Come hang. Come stay with me in my big apartment.
Yeah.
It's paid for by the school. And
oh,
like,
my God.
We always need subs. And I can get you a gig on the weekends, probably, you know, one night a week at least. You can play your music. And so I didn't end up substituting at all, maybe like a handful of times.
Yeah.
And they offered me like just a flat fee to play every night except Thursday. So I'd play like 27 nights a month.
That's how you get good right there.
Yeah. Wow. So it'd be an hour of
just you.
Or did
you
have a bit, I'd do originals for an hour.
Yeah.
And then I'd do like stripped back versions of, you know, Western radio, like
what?
Like pop songs.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
like,
okay.
Like Teenage Dream, Katy Perry, like acoustic, because what would close the language barrier was modern pop, you know, music from the West. So everybody
the bars weren't filled with expats.
No, they'd be, you know, Chinese predominantly clientele.
Whoa.
And then like teachers and other expats that knew each other would visit the bars and come. And so it was really great. I'd take the bus into town and always had dinner, always had plenty of Jameson.
Yeah.
And I made $100 Canadian every night.
Sweet.
Which was more than
enough. And you weren't paying rent.
You know, no rent.
Perfect.
It was just like the perfect rehabilitation time for me. So I spent a lot of that time writing, just kind of quietly observing and trying to get ready at my skill, or get better, sorry, at my craft and skill on my own. And
did you feel like you were getting better?
I think so.
Yeah.
I was starting to write more. So,
because were people connecting with your song, your original songs? If they don't speak the language, it's pretty.
Yeah, they liked my singing voice.
Okay.
And I think at first they also thought that I was just this, you know, anomaly Chinese performer who, you know, had a great English accent and was tall, and, you know, I get Hawaiian, I get Samoan, I get Asian a lot, you know, First Nations, it blends and a little bit. Yeah, I'd go and I'd play my show, and then I'd come back and I would work on original music. You know, I'd have the whole day. I'd have from 1 a.m. till 5 p.m. the next day, kind of thing. It was all my time while my buddy would be at work teaching.
Yeah.
I'd see him on the way out the door to catch the bus and go set up for my, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock set, depending. And then, it really, really brought me back to life. It was a good time, you know.
So what brought you back to Winnipeg?
Well, you're only allowed to stay there for 120 days, like the two visas. And so I came back and just kind of got things rolling again, where I was thinking about, I got to get serious about this. I got to make a record finally. And I thought by this time, you know, 2014, 15, Peguis had seen me on TV a few times. You know, I'd had a couple breakfast television appearances and played some bigger shows that were televised, and they knew that I was a performer, and I'd played in the community and played shows around the city a little bit, and played in a rock band another band called Indian City that, like, mm-hmm. my good mentor who just recently passed, actually, Vince Fontaine.
And, oh, I knew Vince.
Yeah, so Vince Fontaine, you know, he was a mentor of mine, one of my first ones when I came to the city,
okay.
to Winnipeg,
yeah.
and guided me and helped keep my name in the paper, as he put it, you mm-hmm. know, and make a few bucks playing music, so that was always great. It was a tough time, you know, it was a lot of learning and different things, pawning my guitar. I was at the height of smoking cigarettes and,
yeah.
you know, I was really fixated on just smoking weed and writing songs for a long time.
Yeah.
And I still do some of that, you know, but at that point it was new to me, you
right.
know, I was really kind of shaking all these shackles of shame, oppression, and just kind of like finally being my own person and trying to make something of myself, working a job. I changed some oil for a while,
yeah.
you know. I
make a few bucks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was a bouncer at a bar for a little while, and
okay.
I do whatever could pay the bills until, yeah, I worked on country radio for a little bit and like
DJing?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Did some other things too.
Yeah.
And yeah, but all the while, the main thing was always writing songs, you know.
You were more focused on writing than you were performing them.
Yeah. I thought that my
Did you
first,
ever think about being a writer for
that,
other people?
That was the dream.
Oh, yeah. Wow, okay.
Yeah, I'd kind of given up on the idea that, like, you know, somebody like me doesn't typically break open the doors of stardom, I thought, you know, like a large First Nations man. I didn't see any of them really. There weren't really any in the country scene.
Of course, yeah.
You know, I just rest in peace to Shane Yellowbird, who just passed not long ago. But he was only like the third Indigenous person asked to perform on the Grand Ole Opry. And I think of my friend Crystal Shawanda. You know, mm-hmm. she was like somebody I looked up to in the beginning as well. And she really made it seem like I, as an Indigenous person, First Nations person, could go and also, you know, make an impact like that on CMT, Country yeah. Music Television, you know, and used to play in the restaurant or the KFC where my mom worked on the reserve all the time. So, yeah, music was always around in, uh-huh. in that way. So I lived a life that was, I was always listening. I used to listen to way more music back then, just constantly ingesting songs and studying them and trying to learn them. And
Did you model your writing after anyone in particular, or was it just like everything you heard, you were sort of soaking it up?
Yeah, I modeled it mainly off of like alt rock stuff, you know, big epic intro you know, slightly tapered verse. And
I can hear
explosive.
That in your music, like in a subdued kind of different
so
way.
It respects format, you know, it respects like the structure of song, mm-hmm. but that goes back to gospel music too.
Sure.
You know, you learn the verse chorus of things, and then mm-hmm. so yeah, it all plays into the music I write today.
Was there ever any doubt in your mind about the direction that your style of music was going to take? Like when you first did that record with Scott, was there any, like, were you thinking it might be more of a rock record, or like, did that ever come up, or was it just like, this is what's coming out of their sort of finger picky, folky kind of songs, and that's the way you're going to go? Or like, how did you land on that, the sound of that first record?
Well, our first ever demo together was a terrible poppy kind of programmed drum song that I thought was the best. And then I'm so glad it never came out or became anything. But it was really just sitting in his company and watching how he performed and uh-huh. watching, you know, I'm living in Winnipeg for a while now. I'm starting to see local music more.
Yeah.
You know, up until that point, up until my first second years of university, I'm only 17 years old. You know, I skipped a grade, so I was young in university, couldn't go to the bars yet.
Yep.
So the first 8 months of my life living in the city is limited to university. So I'd see people at the coffee shops, you know.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, these are people performing in the quad, you know, and in the front lawn for the first week of university, and like real Winnipeg bands. And so it just kind of gave me that feeling of like everyday folks do this all the time. It's just how much you stay dedicated at it and keep working. And, you know,
was there a period where you did a ton of playing around town to sort of work up the songs, or did you just kind of get into the studio and start working on stuff?
No, I really, my big thing was putting songs on YouTube.
Oh yeah.
So I used to just finish a song and hit record and share it with the world.
Oh, really?
It would get 110 views, yeah. And I felt like I was a songwriter.
Yeah.
That was my first, like, feeling of, I'm sort of doing this. And those early first comments would encourage me, and people would like it a little bit, and just kept me motivated. I wanted to be like Gordy Sampson, truthfully, a country writer.
Yeah.
So I could write.
That's a tough thing to imagine how to do it, really.
Yeah,
like, that's
So in the meantime, I thought, I'll just get better at it.
Uh-huh.
And then when the time comes that I can actually put those wheels in motion, I'll have some songs to show.
You know,
I'm still waiting on that. I'd love to write a Jesus Take the Wheel and then just, you know, use that to keep funding my own mountain climbing and such.
Yeah.
But yeah, eventually got to a point where I had all these songs and there's nobody to sing them. I didn't really know about publishing or placements. I didn't have a manager, an agency, anything. It was just me and the hopes of doing it professionally one day. And so stuck with it, and it led to this place where I eventually made a record that just sounded like me, you know? And wow, who would have thought that that's what people wanted to hear?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
was that process pretty quick? Like, how did you guys get that
record
done?
10 days.
10 days from beginning, from like including mixing and everything?
Yeah, super modest budget. It was like, you know, a couple takes per thing. And then basically it was the Scott Nolan band. Like Scott played drums, bass, keys, guitars on it for me.
Yeah.
So we kept the costs low. And
did you get some funding from like Manitoba?
No, I got funding again from my home reserve. I had written a 40-page proposal.
Whoa.
Showing my path to stardom.
Okay.
You know, I said, if you could just give me the seeds, I promise I'll turn this into an orchard of some sort, you know. And I'm so thankful to them because of, you know, seeing me on TV and watching me advance, playing these bigger shows, Indigenous Day Live, like some of my first big shows in Canada on a national stage. That was enough for them to say, okay, he's obviously doing this for real. Let's support it. So they gave me some money, again, very modest, and just I was able to get the artwork and get it mixed and mastered. You learn, you know, I watched my dad make records, so I knew how much it was going to cost and what it would take. And then I thought, once I have a physical copy of a CD in my hand, it's off to the races. But yeah, you learn that's not all of it either.
Mm-hmm.
You got to tour, you got to get somewhere else.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So did you start touring right away after that record came out?
Not traditional touring, like in a van, playing bars. I had the record. I played it around town a little bit. I was starting to get a little bit of buzz because they put a song on the radio, and then that kind of, I was the new fresh thing, you know, and that was really great. The power of discovery, almost shock discovery. Like, I've never heard a voice like this in a while. And he's Indigenous, he's from Manitoba, and, you know, it's resonating, it's doing well. And then,
where were you getting airplay? Was it on like CBC or?
Yeah, it would have been CBC.
Yeah.
So people were starting to get to know me in Canada, and then on the Indigenous Music Countdown. So that was great to get my name out a little bit. And we submitted the record to the Junos just to, you know, just so it's documented that this, whoever this William Prince guy is, he at least submitted, and maybe come some years down the line, we'll really consider his album for a nomination. And I just finished playing one of the toughest like 6-person house shows in Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh boy.
And you know, I woke up in the Smoky Ramada, and I was, you know, double nominated, and everybody suddenly knew who I was.
Yeah.
So that was
what,
like,
what did that album get nominated for?
Roots Contemporary Album of the Year is the one I won. Yeah. And then also Indigenous Recording of the Year.
Yeah.
So those two categories, I was truthfully shocked, because up until then, there was only one person nominated of Indigenous descent for the Roots Contemporary.
Yeah.
As Buffy St. Marie.
Wow.
So I was the second,
good company, man.
The second in history.
Yeah.
And then after I got nominated, it seems every year now, there's a new Indigenous nominee in the Roots Contemporary category. Friends of mine, you know, that have won, like Leela Gilday and Julian Taylor being nominated. And just now they've created a traditional Indigenous category.
Oh,
so
this
that
is,
the more modern tradition, more modern Indigenous music can also hold a place while not taking away from things such as drumming and Inuit throat singing and such. So that category expanding is always good for helping people discover other Indigenous talent.
Yeah. Yeah, I played with Julian down here, actually, when he was here at Americana last year.
You know, everybody.
Oh,
that's great.
You're
a man of the people.
A man of the people. So tell me a bit about the new record. I'd love to hear about the process a little bit and maybe how this one has been different for you. I guess tell me how the whole thing with Dave Cobb started. You mentioned that you just said to the label, like, this is the guy that I think I'd love to work with. And they just made it happen. And that
made the connections. Uh-huh. And
did you come down and hang out with them and sort of like hash things out a little bit? Yeah.
Well, it was right to work pretty much. Yeah. I love it because it's such a fond memory. I walk over to RCA, I go in, there they all are sitting on the couch.
So this needs a little bit of clarification because people don't know the magnitude of RCA, but Dave Cobb works out of RCA Studio A, which is...
Used to, at the time, working out of.
So that's like Chet Atkins's room, and it's probably the biggest tracking room I've ever been in my life. It's incredible. And there's so much history in there. It's bananas, the shit that happened in there. Yeah. Was that intimidating at all? Or was it just a totally comfortable atmosphere? Or what was the deal?
Yeah, I walked in and, you know, they're so down to earth that all that stuff kind of goes to the wayside right away. You see these, you know, 8-foot tall platinum Chris Stapleton records that are like, you know, leaning against the wall. You see John Prine's Christmas Tree.
Yeah.
You know, you think of Brandy recording in that room. You think of, you know, Jason Isbell's 400 unit record is tucked on the side. You see the Grammys on the console. And then you just meet Dave, who is this down-to-earth music lover who makes you feel right at home and brings the best out of you in that way of getting to know you. You know, we didn't jump to work. We just sat there and talked. And
so this is Reliever.
This is Breathless.
Oh, okay.
This is Breathless from the Earthly Days record. So I did one song first time.
Oh, cool.
That felt really good. So naturally, we did half a record here.
Yeah, so how did that, like, what do you mean by half a record?
Well, I did 5 songs.
Okay, so you literally, like, you completed half the record here. And
so I did 5 songs off of Reliever with Dave, and then the other 6 were with Scott in Winnipeg. It was like a split effort.
Yeah. Was that done just because you wanted to do some in Winnipeg, or?
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to fully depart from the thing that, you know, won me a Juno. Like,
I
really love that place, the song shop, and it just felt comfortable to make music. So I thought naturally I would go make the record there. And then it was under some advice that, like, it'd be good to go branch out and try something. And so we were able to go work with Dave for a few of those songs.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it elevated the experience of recording for me. And it just started to change the way I'd even record. And the way it sounded, it was just indisputable how great it can sound.
Did he set you up in his sort of traditional way of, like, everyone in pretty tight together in that massive room?
Yeah, tight little circle and a couple carpets. And
all with his guys, or did you bring people down with you? Or
no, he had some people there for me. Yeah.
So I don't know who played on Reliever. Like, who were the musicians on that record here?
Chris Powell played the drums on it. Adam Gardner, he played bass, on Breathless. But there are a number of people after the fact, like, because we would cut the acoustic and the bass and the drums.
Okay. So just, and the vocals or just...
Yeah,
okay.
Two acoustics, vocal, bass, drums. So it was the four
and
of
Dave
us.
And Dave does the other acoustic usually. Like, yeah, I know he likes to be in there strumming a guitar.
And then I feel bad. I don't remember the names right now, but like...
That's all right.
I remember Kristen Rogers. She sang. She sings with Eric Church now a lot.
Yeah.
But she sang harmonies on it. And this guy, Phil, who plays with... Anderson East, great piano player. He's in the photos. I believe he played on it too.
Okay.
And
so you did some overdubs and stuff. So the core band was
core band
you bass, drums, and Dave.
Yeah, and he'd send it around and get parts or bring people in.
So this was it done in 2019 or something?
The Reliever record?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was January, I think, of 2019. We would have been recording, getting ready for the February 2020 release.
Ooh, terrible.
Yeah, well, it's a year later, and or maybe it was in May, I think, something like that.
I just mean terrible because of COVID.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was fun.
Did your record get delayed for COVID at all?
Nope.
Or just
came out February 7th.
Oh, my God. COVID, so it came out pre-COVID.
COVID wasn't a thing.
Oh, my God.
And then a month later, you know.
Did that derail some touring plans and stuff?
Everything. I got dropped. You know, I was a tax write-off for the label I was working with.
Oh, wow.
Didn't really get to do much with Reliever in the States. We had a huge tour planned. It was the year of the USA.
Oh, man.
Katie Pruitt was taking me out on a bunch of dates, and that was kind of like my first time I was going to go to New Orleans Jazz Fest. That
got
pushed back.
Yeah.
You know, I had a whole 6 months lined up where I was going to trek across the States and share this record. And a lot of that stuff got rescheduled 3-4 times and eventually just
evaporated.
Yeah.
So how was it different this time? And when did you do the new record?
We can talk
about it as if it has come out, because by the time this podcast comes out, the record will be out.
Well, it started the first week of, it would have been the first week of May. 2 weeks in May, I went down to Savannah, Georgia, where Dave has his new studio set up. He's kind of migrating the scene over there.
Tell me about that scene over there.
Yeah, well, it's him, you know.
What's he set up in?
His home.
It's so in the house.
He's got a converted garage.
Has he left RCA? Like, he's not there anymore?
Yeah, he's not there anymore.
Wow. He lives in Savannah.
Yeah, he bought a home out there and...
He just digs it, or is there something going on there?
Well, he's originally from Georgia.
Oh, right.
So he's from there.
Yeah.
And then he shared that he was just, you know, wanting to be closer to family, mm-hmm. to be with them and look after them and such. And he was building. So the first studio is in that garage, but there's going to be a new building where he moves the entire studio to away from the house and such. But so to be one of the first recordings, he had just finished Greta Van Fleet and the War and Treaty when I showed up. So
there's some mojo in there already.
It was great. I got drinking the tequila. I don't drink tequila, like I said, and he converted me to the Blanco, and it was really great. And I got to bring my really good friend Mike T. Kerr from Toronto down. He's an American citizen, dual citizen, graduated from Berkeley, a true wizard on the guitar. So all the electric is Mike T. Kerr on this record. But yeah, Stand in the Joy. It's very much about me being vulnerable enough to just express my joy and happiness and really share that with everybody. You know, I've dealt with a lot of grief and loss, mm-hmm. and heartbreak and... in its own melancholy way, but yet hopeful. And this time it was about focusing on love and time, like thinking of my own mortality and like, mm-hmm. what's the point of all these great successes and blessings and things if you're not going to truly enjoy them? You know, I'm doing a bit of a disservice to those that love me and want me to do well by, you know, not fully embracing it and not allowing myself out of the fear that it might go away, or, you know, who I was in a different time, a different life, isn't worthy of the joy and things that have manifested now. That was a lot of learning and unlearning, going to therapy and, you know, writing songs. I realized I've written songs while in love with people, but these are the first songs that I've written while truly loving somebody. Mm-hmm. That's my wife to be. I'm newly engaged.
And congrats.
So thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited about this next chapter of life, you know, having a wife. And again, my son Wyatt, who's just my world, you know, he really, really brings so much joy. So it's focused on them. It's like, take stock of the life you have right now. It's real. You're not an imposter. You know,
yep.
You can... And again, that stems from a life of hills and valleys where sometimes we wouldn't share our joy, our happiness, our accomplishments, because so many family members and friends living on reserve are suffering and dealing with the effects of no opportunity, of lack of resources and, you know, ways of dealing with trauma and alcoholism, substance abuse, all these things that plague the First Nations of Canada to this day. And that were the direct result of colonization and removal of culture and language. Like, we have people swimming, missing an identity, and because of that, they tend to, you know, harm themselves and harm those that they love. So I grew up right around that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so thankful for the love of my parents that kind of zeroed in on me and said, there's more to life than this, and we want you to do well in school or music eventually. And now, you know, if my dad was still here, he'd be so proud and happy about all the things we're doing. So, yeah, stand in the joy is proclaiming that, saying, look at me, look at this person from this Peguis First Nation Reserve, getting to stand on the Grand Ole Opry stage.
Yeah,
insane. Getting to open these shows for incredible artists that I admire. Getting to make records with the greatest producer of our time right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, making friendships with real artists who consider me a peer. Like, it's all about acceptance and belonging, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody wants that. Everybody wants a purpose that drives them, that fulfills them, I believe. And, you know, to fit in, you know, I'd... bit of an outsider for a while, and then now I'm getting to a place that who I am is who people want to be around and are happy to know. So believe it, you know. It's right here, it's real, we're doing this, we're on the podcast, we're in Nashville talking about album 4 of all things. When I didn't even get album 1, I didn't know if that was going to ever happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like that first decade was about acknowledging some of the pain that really shaped me and what I had survived, the trauma of it all and different things with family and growing up on the reserve and, you know, separation from partner, the death of my dad, you know, my own health taking different turns.
Yeah, that'll do it.
And then now is about, hey, you made it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be an example, be a light and keep...
Be joyful.
Be joyful, keep shining, because... Joy is a little foreign for me. Like, it was like, why be happy? Why celebrate when it's just going to go away, you know? So now I'm being brave and saying, yes, this is my life that I have made and I love. No one's going to take it from me. You can enjoy it. Leave a good memory for your son. Yeah. Don't want a grouchy old dad, you know, stomping around the house because he's depressed. And so I fight against, I kick against it all the time and say, no, I'm going to be gentler with those I love. I'm going to watch how I speak. I'm not going to raise my voice anymore. I don't want to be sarcastic and rude because, you know, Broken Heart of Mine tells the story of all those things that I'm trying to change and trying to live longer, trying to get my health right, all those things that are important.
Tell me about that song, because that's like a classic country. Like, nobody really writes songs like that anymore or pulls them off. The thing that's cool about that is, like, you aren't mimicking that style at all. Like, you're totally doing your own thing. But, man, it's like a classic country ringer.
Yeah, I love that you say that. Thank you. I try to think, like,
most people that do stuff like that, it sounds affected or something. You don't sound affected.
Well, you know, one of the coolest parts is having Paul Franklin on that song.
I was going to say, you know, he's one of my heroes.
Steel guitar is just, I really, I was passionate about including steel guitar on that song. I sought that sound, mm-hmm. and I wanted it to sound like an old country song, because a song like that is one that truly resonates with the people that might be having a party in the garage on the reserve with a couple cases of beer for the weekend, and
yeah.
allows you to take stock for a second and say, you know, this broken heart of mine is my own doing. It's my own way of pushing people away that has me lonely. It's my own lack of patience and respect, and mm-hmm. kind of, you know, counterintuitive to the wisdom I proclaim to adhere to through the seven teachings, the seven sacred grandfather teachings of First Nations, Anishinaabe. That's like love and humility, truth, respect, honesty, wisdom, you know, all these different things that kind of make up my core value system. And that's what I want to be. I want to be all those things. But everybody deserves to know the full story. I'm not trying to be some phony out here who's some pastor, some healer, some music man thing. Nothing like that. I'm just a human being living out the human experience, trying to be better every day, trying to bring light and positivity into the world. And that's, even that can make you feel self-conscious, because it's not as romantic as stumbling with the whiskey bottle and smoking myself till I have no voice left. And that's the path I was going down mm-hmm. for a while. You know, I got a whiskey bottle tattooed on my arm because at one point in life, that was it. You know, yeah. I was really struggling, having a hard time. But with my diabetes, with my predisposition to heart disease, and being a little overweight as an indigenous man, that stuff's just going to send me to an early grave. And mm-hmm. I got to really take hold of that, because I want to live long for my son's wedding.
Yeah. You know,
I want to play golf with him when he's 37.
Right.
I want to see his dreams come to fruition and not be in a wheelchair or not able to make it up the stairs to witness it. You know, that's something that I've had to contend with my own family. And so, yeah, Stand in the Joy is very much my declaration and saying, I'm gonna really stand here in the light of what I have. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna sit and grieve what I lost or what I don't have, because pretty happy with the way things are going.
So the Broken Heart of Mine song, like, did you set out to write a straight up country song? Was that something that you like, did you sit down and say, I'm going to write me a country song?
You will
today?
Not believe how that song came to be. I drove out to the Saugeen First Nation to participate in an indigenous ceremony.
Yeah.
And it was just about cleansing. It was about talking about lessons with an elder who had since passed, Dave Kershane, an elder who guided me and helped me through a really difficult time that I was living through. And in my car, without music, without anything, I wrote every bit of that song, sang it into my iPhone.
Yeah.
And I was like, Broken Heart of Mine, like, come on, like, that's as, you know, that's almost as simple as Always Have What We Had, you know, like, that's yeah. another one of those songs. And it just felt like its own thing. And I wanted it to have country staple feel.
Uh-huh.
You know, people already, I've only played that song for a handful of people, and they immediately think George Jones, which is wild to think about.
It does sound like a George Jones song.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's just the old country I grew up finding its way to the surface. So no other explanation other than...
It was effortless, though. It wasn't something that you labored over.
No.
That's so cool.
Those ones are the best. They almost write themselves in a rush. Like, they just pour out of you. And I'm thankful for those songs, because there are some that you labor with and give time or shy from, or they just don't become things sometimes. And that one...
Did Paul Franklin join you guys in the studio, or was that an overdub?
No, it was after, because originally we weren't going to put the steel on, thinking that it might be too country.
Too country, yeah, yeah.
And I said, nope, country it up. I want it. So I was driving out to Peguis, just getting cell signal again, and Paul and Brandon Bell called me from the studio and said, hey, you know, I got Paul here. And then I got to talk to Paul Franklin, and he just like gushed about the song.
Yeah.
He's like, William, I'm just sitting here. I want to do that kind of sparse leading kind of George Jones thing. And I was just like, my face was hurting from smiling, talking to him, and just thinking of, you know, of course, his history, but the fact that those worlds come together for a moment and he's playing on my record. And
yeah,
a really unforgettable contribution.
Amazing.
We'll, live forever.
Yeah. But in general, was that record done in a similar way where it was like you and Dave and some of the other people in that play on the record
in the house? And small, we were in a room this big,
okay,
just like this.
Yeah.
And in a circle, Dave was behind a wall to cut the bleed.
Yeah.
Mike T, my friend Mike T Kerr, was across from me.
Mm-hmm.
He had a guitar. Brian Allen on bass.
Yeah.
And Chris Powell was downstairs in a drum room on camera. So we were watching him on a video screen.
Are
we
those guys from Savannah? Yeah. Or are they from here?
No, they're from Nashville.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they came over for the 2 weeks. And I had to go to a New Orleans Jazz Fest in the middle of recording, too. So for one night, I popped over there and played a show. Stevie Nicks was playing that night.
Oh.
And like, it was great. Back my first time to New Orleans. And then I came right back, got back to work. Then my my partner showed up the second week, and she did all the harmonies in 2 days.
Oh, cool.
So she sings with me. Nobody knows my voice better than she does. And
she's
on the cover, and this whole record is truthfully an ode to her and her love and what it brings to my life, you know?
Yeah.
Stand in the Joy is about what she does. She has such a beautiful, light heart and can laugh things off, not be so serious, and, you know, nothing pins her down. I admire her spirit, and the song Tanqueray, you know, tells our love story.
That's a great song.
Pretty much start to where it is now. And I think of Goldie Hawn's another song.
Yeah, tell me about that song.
I love that song just because it's my tribute to women. Women are just the greatest, you know, they're just better. And everybody that works at Six Shooter Records, my whole life, my tour manager, my sound person, my partner, you know, women who are all so incredible in their own ways. And I thought that every person I mentioned in that song, I mentioned, you know, Goldie Hawn, the actress, right away, the movie Cactus Flower, her first performance won her an Academy Award, you know, and I think of Georgia O'Keeffe, like the beautiful art, the modern beauty. And I think of Joni Mitchell, this the sound of, and the spirit of Joni. My partner possesses pieces of that. So I thought, why not write it out? And then her favorite flowers are yellow. So I picked some yellow flowers for the final verse and wanted to share it. So it's my way of saying, you know why I love you so much? It's because you're kind of like Joni this way. You're kind of like Goldie this way. And
love it.
You know, incredible women to pay tribute to. And I'm so thrilled with that song, the way it turned out.
The guitar playing on that song is cool too, like the finger picking stuff. Can you just tell me a little bit about that? Like as far as how your guitar playing has kind of evolved and who you were into, like maybe like a John Prine kind of influence there,
totally.
I guess, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, taking lessons with Mike in Toronto on Zoom once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surrounded by,
is it something you work on? Like,
you
do?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't a very good guitar player when I made my first record. Like, I was a rhythm player.
Yeah,
you know, not much of a finger picker yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something I'm constantly working on, like trying to get better. Because if you want to contend in folk music, you know, with the Gordon Lightfoots and all these people that play with thumb picks and such, you know, I need to up my abilities so that I could write better songs.
Mm-hmm.
John Prine apparently played with two fingers. That's how I play, essentially, thumb and pointer. But then just incorporating the roll, using every finger then to get that kind of classic, you know, bass sound going.
Is there a little like maybe Mississippi John Hurt or some kind of blues stuff in there too? Was that ever a thing for you?
I didn't really take to the blues as much. I liked a little bit of B.B. King, and it's tough to say Clapton's name now these days, but like he was an earlier influence where I just thought he was great. And then I studied that. My brother was a guitar player too, who loved the blues. So I kind of knew the basics, and you know, country gospel, it's a cousin of that stuff. You think of the turnarounds and the lead ups and the seventh chords and the chords leading into other chords and such. So it's all part of it. But I think with that song only has one part. It's four chords, one part over and over and over again, the entirety of the song.
Yep.
So to make it what it is, where it feels like it has all these different points of, you know, almost contention and then climax at the end kind of thing. And That's just the brilliance of Dave Cobb and the musicians I got to work with.
So sonically, there's sort of like, there's your finger picking on one side kind of thing, and then there's like another finger picking thing on the other side. Is that you doing both, or is that Dave?
No, Dave's doing the acoustic lead line, and okay. then Mike's doing the electric lead line. He's also okay. playing this really cool, like crystallized affected guitar yeah, that yeah. sounds like a delay and echoey reverbs and such. And
do you get your mitts into that kind of stuff at all? Like as far as like instructing what you're looking for, or does he just, you just sort of give him free rein to do his thing, or how does that work?
Yeah, I trust the others with mm-hmm. their specialty. You know, yeah. I try to bring a really good song to the core.
Yeah.
And from there, they're hard to mess up. You know, as Dave says, you know, like if you just let them.
Oh, you can mess them up.
Yeah, you can let them lead the way, you know.
Yeah.
That's the thing. We're here to serve the song,
yeah.
not get in its way. And so subtlety is really great. And I was insecure about my playing. And that's just another thing that feels like a big brother thing. Nah, man, your playing is great. We're going to do this together. We're going to, mm-hmm. we're going to cut this thing and you're a part of it. And these are your songs. And like,
yeah,
I would just hire the Monkees, you know, the Wrecking Crew monkey style and just have the greatest players. But then my soul is not in there.
Yeah.
What's at the heart of these songs is the way they were written at my kitchen table. They were elevated. Songs like Young, Young had about the most done to it, I'd say.
As far as like the song itself, or like
from
sonically?
Where it started okay. to where it is now, to follow the melody of my voice with the actual guitar chords, more of a piano thing.
Yeah.
To put that into guitar language was a really great change that challenges me now. And
do you write on the piano at all? Because piano is a big part of the record and of yeah, like all your records.
Lee
right?
Pardini did all okay. the piano on that record.
You don't play, you don't write on the piano ever?
No, I play very simple piano. Mm-hmm. I can chord and yeah. but I'm not a player yet. That's part of my 5-year plan. I want to be like good. Neil, where I can yeah. switch to
pull
the
off
piano.
A show doing some piano. Yeah. That's a good goal.
But Lee was really tasteful too. It's quite incredible like how the moments work out. My mom was in Winnipeg watching Chris Stapleton at the big arena.
Mm-hmm.
And Lee Pardini has recently joined Chris on tour playing organ and piano.
Okay.
Plays with Dawes.
Yeah.
And he's like a favorite of a lot of people that I know. And I had just gotten familiar with him through the record. And we haven't met. I haven't had the pleasure. But he did such an incredible job. And I'm so thankful that he was part of it. So.
Oh, so his stuff was done remotely?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So he had played in Winnipeg. The night before he flew home to Nashville,
way. Yeah,
my mom watching him on stage.
That's crazy.
The next thing he would do is go home to his studio and record all the organs and piano and keyboard for my record.
Wicked.
So that
was
must
like, have freaked her right out.
That was a cool thing. I was like, do you realize that guy you were watching on stage last night yeah. went home and did all this stuff for me? It was yeah. just incredible.
Wow. So the new record is out, and are you going to be, what's the touring situation? Are you going to be at it full tilt, or do you try and keep that to a reasonable level, or what's your take on all that?
Yeah, you know, like I say, the year of the USA, I'm touring with the Warren Treaty for a month.
Oh, yeah.
So the record comes out and then we hit the road. So that's going to be great.
Yeah.
Looking forward to
They're nice guys.
Oh, yeah. Really, really sweet.
Will you play solo, or do you have a band with you?
Solo, yeah. I'm doing half-hour opening sets.
Yeah.
So be my tour manager and my fiance and I.
Beautiful.
Hitting the road and, you know, town to town kind of thing.
Yeah.
They're really generous with bringing me, and I'm looking forward to it. Like I say, it extends my life in a way. You can't just tour Canada forever.
That's right.
And so it's really, really important to me that I start playing these festivals in every state, and just the exposure right now. I'm a rookie, you know, I'm starting to climb, and I'm thankful for the connections I've made. Like Katy Pruitt, you know, being from Nashville, and mm-hmm. my friend Allison Russell, who's just had the most incredible year with Outside
Child. I was in
her
band for about 5 years. So.
Oh my goodness. All right.
and I, well, actually we sort of grew up together in Vancouver. So
wow.
I've known her for 25 years or so.
Well, she's a gem.
She lives a block down.
Jeez.
Yeah. She's done pretty good.
Lived with Yola for a while too there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Yola took me on the road as well.
Oh, did she?
Which
oh, cool.
Really sweet. We did the UK together, so her presence is just really felt in this town now too.
Yeah,
you know, just feet from stardom.
Yeah.
Wilder things have happened.
Well, this Opry thing is pretty massive. That's crazy. So did that come out of the blue, or were you kind of, was that something you were trying for, or how did that happen?
It felt out of the blue. Most things do, you know. I'm really minding my own business when Shauna, my manager, will just chime in, hey, guess what, you know, and brings the good news, and then, all right, I guess we're doing this thing. But I almost didn't believe it at first. I was just like the Opry, like the Grand Ole Opry.
And
I was like, I'm going to go play there. And like, yeah, it's ready to go. And it's still hitting me now. Like it's
tomorrow, right?
Saturday.
Oh, Saturday. Okay.
Yeah.
That's nutty.
So I get to do two songs.
Two songs. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to do When You Miss Someone and Breathless.
Nice. So,
everybody loves Elvis again right now.
Yeah. Are you freaked out about it, or is it just going to be a gig?
No, I'm excited.
Nice.
I'm ready to go.
All right.
It'll be great.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
And you've got a gig here at Third and Lindsley?
Yeah, playing for the Noon Hour radio show.
The WMOT thing.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
They're having me on to sing a song or two.
Yeah.
So that's a good experience. I think I'm really fortunate, like, to have help in some way. I think that's the way of saying that there is room for me here, you know?
Feels like it.
There needs to be somebody. There needs to be a First Nations Americana star, and I volunteer as tribute. You know, I'm here.
I'll do it. All right.
Fine. You know.
I love it. Well, that's exciting, man. I'm really excited for you. I'm always thrilled when Canadians come down and play on the Opry. I saw Allie when she was on the Opry. Her debut was probably a year ago, I guess, and it was pretty exciting for her.
Yeah,
I think she was kind of freaking out, but sounds like you got it under control.
Great things happen, you know. I'm history is always it's exciting to me to think of what it means, and like just the, you know, the people that have stood on the old section, and it just makes me feel like it's all the work is paying off. Like, get your name said there, be seen on that stage, and then I'm not such a stranger to this place. You know, I've been in studios while I've been in town. I'm going to play the basement one time. I got to play that venue, you know?
Yep.
And yeah, we're playing the Brooklyn Bowl with Warren Treaty when they come back at the end of the tour.
It's a great venue.
Yeah. So that's going to be a nice experience. And
yeah. Are you doing any like Canadian festivals or anything in the summer? Like, do you do that?
Yeah, there'll be a couple.
Yeah.
They pop up, and Canada is so good to me. They want me to come see them and play for them. And I just wrapped a massive tour in the fall that was really successful, my biggest to date. And
oh, cool.
Yeah, I'm really happy because I'm starting to be able to bring my band in Canada more and more. It's nice. It's a recalibrating record, you know? These are love songs. These aren't gospel songs. These aren't songs with an asterisk. These aren't songs as duets. This is just me re-entering the octagon and saying, you know,
here I
am. These are the songs I like to write. This is how I feel, and stand in the joy. That's going to start off the next decade of this journey, and I'm
wicked.
Happy. I'm happy.
Well, good for you, man.
Thank
you. I'm excited for you.
Oh, geez.
And thanks for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime. Let's do another one.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening, everybody. Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast is produced at the Hen House Studio in East Nashville, Tennessee. Please remember to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist for Spotify and Apple Music, at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thank you again to our sponsors this season, Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra 1964, The Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resonator Guitars, and The Hen House Hang. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Over and out.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.